Attention crew, this is your Captain Caliban speaking. This is a supplemental episode of Enterprising Individuals, where we bring you news and tidbits from the world of Trek, also interviews with special guests, and a few little surprises along the way. We have got a fantastic show for you today, and we're going to go right into it, but first I just wanted to mention two bits of Trek news you may or may not have heard. The first is the sad news of the death of Herb Solo at the age of 89. Herb was an executive producer for Desilu back in the days of the original series, and he was vital in getting Star Trek on the air and keeping it going. He was also an executive producer on Desilu's other big shows, like Mission Impossible and Mannix, and he was an EP on The Man from U.N.C.L.E. as well at MGM-TV. He was also a writer and creator. He co-created The Man from Atlantis, if you remember that, and he wrote for that series, and he adapted Theodore Sturgeon's Killdozer for the cinema. And he seems like, you know, everything I've heard about him, he was just a really nice guy and obviously a talented producer and TV man. He published his recollections of developing Star Trek along with the recollections of producer Bob Justman in the book Inside Star Trek, which I would recommend to anyone who is interested in what it was like in the early days of Trek and Desilu. And I'd like to do something in the future on the show looking more into the efforts of people like Herb and Bob in the creation of Trek. I was actually working on a script this last year to that end, and, you know, I didn't know that our time with Herb would be cut short. It's an old show, Star Trek, you know, and there's this whole generation of people who are slipping away right in front of our eyes, who made this awesome thing all those years ago. Not Shatner, of course. He'll be at all of our funerals. He's never going away, but R.I.P. to Herb. Check out Inside Star Trek if you can, or the TV documentary that they made out of the book. Herb's in that too. The other bit of news is that Simon & Schuster, the publisher of Star Trek books, has been sold to Penguin Random House, and I don't know how to feel about it. Once Viacom and CBS merged, they made it clear they had no interest in being in the publishing business, so it's good that SNS is actually going to a good home, but this means there's only like four big publishers in the publishing world left. You'll probably recognize that Penguin Random House is a rather random name for a publishing company, and that's because Penguin, just a few years ago, merged with Random House, and at that time, the thought pieces were like, well, now there's only five major publishers, so on and so forth. So the collapse inward of the publishing industry has been a troubling thing to watch. As you know, many of the guests on this show are published Star Trek authors, and it's been interesting to read their social media feeds. There's a lot of trepidation. There's no real bad news just yet, but I'll obviously keep you posted about what this could mean for future Star Trek books. Okay, this week on the show, I'm speaking with Will Wynn of the organization Socialist Revolution. Did you vote this year? I hope you did. I told you like a million times to do it. When you did your heart sink a little? Did you wonder why you were being forced to choose between, like, the worst possible options on either side? Did you think about the fact that there were only two choices, and at least economically, they resembled each other quite a bit? Will is known generally online as the Star Trek Communist, and it's for two reasons. One, he has some of the most on-point Starfleet cosplay this side of Star Trek Las Vegas. The guy has the togs, and he wears them well. The other reason is that he is a tireless advocate for Marxist and socialist ideals and how they can make our world better and hopefully one day help usher in a future like the one we see in Star Trek. Now, that doesn't mean that he's 100% satisfied with the economy of the Federation because, let's face it, what economy? Captain Picard loves to brag about how Federation citizens don't spend their lives trying to hoard wealth, but we certainly don't see a bunch of Romulanists running around the Federation. How did humanity really solve its problems of economic inequality and class struggle, and what role might communism have played in it? Well, that's what Will and I discuss on this episode. And really, it's a fascinating discussion, and it's very educational as well. Something that we talk about in the interview is that the general level of education in America concerning economic systems and how they operate is woefully inadequate. Like, my econ class in high school, I barely remember, but it was basically them spinning me around three times, screaming Adam Smith, and then just stamping capitalism on my forehead. But Will has got it covered because he goes into depth about the language and terminology that oppressed people need to express their oppression, which we're sorely lacking. Now, if you want to know more, you can go to socialistrevolution.org. We mentioned that again at the end of the interview, so check that out. And that's it for me. We'll be back next week. Enjoy the interview. See you at the meeting. And with that, let's get underway. My guest on the show today is Will Wen. Will is known online as the Star Trek Communist, and he works with the Socialist Revolution Organization, which is the U.S. section of International Marxist Tendency. Will, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you aboard. I always ask new guests on the show how they first became Star Trek fans. How did you discover Star Trek?
Well, I think I discovered it with a bunch of other folks within my, age cohort watching Next Generation in syndication.
Yeah.
I feel like the thing with Trek comes in waves, right? There's the original waves. I watched it in 1966, then watched it when it was canceled, watched the animated series, watched Next Generation. Other folks got in with the new JJ movies and what have you, but I watched it on syndication when it was on, and I just love the fact that, Next Generation really was my Trek, and it was really much my my comfort food growing up.
Yeah, me too. It's funny that, I was the same way, because you get that sort of reinforcement of seeing it on TV and then going in and to school the next day, and everybody's like, oh man, did you see the thing with the Borg? And you just kind of keep perpetuating it like that. Although I know a couple young people recently who watched some of the CBS stuff, but they maybe caught something on a Netflix or just watched a random episode of Voyager, and suddenly like they're these huge Voyager fans of this show that was off, 5 years before they were born. And I think that's cool too.
Yeah, that's what I love about Star Trek. There's so much of it.
Yeah,
you really can is. Constantly find new fans. There's so many entry points.
Yeah.
Which is the wonderful thing about it.
Yeah, it really is. One of those points is cosplaying, and you're a cosplayer. I think that's how I first became aware of you, seeing you in various Starfleet uniforms on social media. How many outfits do you have?
Oh, I think is it a good or a bad sign? I've kind of lost track.
I think that's telling.
I would say at this point, probably I can tell you the ones I don't have, actually.
Sure.
So I'm still looking for a good Enterprise NX-01 jumpsuit. Mm. Still looking for a good, I actually love the good motion picture uniforms. They don't get enough love, I don't think.
Yeah.
And I don't have the new Lower Decks uniforms either. Yeah, I think they're really snazzy. But I think I have, I think in particular, I think everything from Next Gen onwards. So we got Next Gen, Voyager, Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
The First Contact movie uniforms. I think those have down, even the new Picard uniforms. And it's just fun because I think, like I said, each era has its own flavor.
Yeah.
But, it's still recognizable. It's fun to wear, and it's fun to join with others, because I think that energy and that love, that enthusiasm is infectious. And, you're literally wearing it on your sleeve, your fandom in a way. So it's a lot of fun.
I think for a couple of years ago, I decided every con that I went to, I was going to cosplay. And by the end of the year, I felt exhausted just trying to brainstorm outfits and assemble them and going to surplus stores to get all the little bits and bobs that you have to glue on them. Do you have any advice for anybody who wants to get into cosplay but doesn't really know where to start?
Sure. So I would say it's finding what you're comfortable with, I think, in a lot of ways. With Star Trek, it's a little easier because on some levels there's a gradation, and because there's so much variety, and because I choose to kind of do a lot of Starfleet uniforms, a lot of them interchangeable. So, a lot of the TNG uniforms, I could use the same pants for a lot of them, right?
I can
mix and match, or I can use different comm badges. I am an avid fan that likes to wear those types of things, but I am not like so many other talented cosplayers I know of that actually make their uniforms by hand, which is really fantastic. That doesn't mean that doesn't mean you have to do those things, but there's a whole level of entry, just like within the actual franchise itself. You can enter a cosplay wearing there are a lot of cardigans and sweaters that are very cut, like the color blocks of uniform,
sure.
And putting on a comm badge. That's just as legitimate as a casual cosplay to show your fandom as it is someone that makes their own Borg costume with the implants and the electronics, all those types of things. And you can have your passions expressed through all sorts of ways, even with a very high level of skills and all that kind of stuff. So for me, my advice is just to, I know some people probably get self-conscious, you know, putting that stuff, stuff on. I think, you know, it always gets easier after the first time. People are very welcoming. In a lot of ways, you know, I think geek culture and dressing up for conventions, it doesn't have the same stigma as it used to. It's actually very in now in a lot of ways.
Sure.
So it all, it all depends on what you want to do. Just have fun with it and, don't let anyone tell you that, oh, you're not caught, you know, gatekeeping cosplay. Oh, this is not, screen accurate, or this is not particular, it's not, done sophisticated enough. Whatever you do that you enjoy, that's the important thing with cosplay.
Yeah. That's what makes it fun.
It can't be a chore. Absolutely not.
Yeah, right. Well, your cosplay's on point. It's certainly given you a distinctive presence online as a Star Trek communist. How did you first discover Marxism?
So that's a good question, right? So a lot of people, I think, in the same way that I discovered, my love of Star Trek, my love of my fandom that way, I think with politics, the same way. We learn through experiences. We learn through various entry points. And I think now, more than ever, I think, people kind of know deep down on a gut level that things aren't working, right? But they aren't taught a vocabulary to understand why things aren't working. They just seem to be, hey, everyone's more angry. You know, people are working longer and harder, earning less, can't get by. What's going on? Why can't we just live, right? Why can't we just live, decent lives, not have to worry about, living paycheck to paycheck. Why does everything have to be a struggle? Why is everything so hard? And in a lot of ways, watching Star Trek, it presents that future without explicitly saying that it's a revolutionary future. But with the political analysis that Marxism gives, which is basically analyzing the world through the lens of materialism or material analysis and of class struggle, you understand that that's actually how a Star Trek future can only be achieved. And it can only be achieved through class struggle, meaning the working class has to be in power. And the workers, right, the workers of the world, like Rom said, workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains. And it's very true in the sense that we create all the wealth in society. The workers do, right? In a lot of ways, in almost every single way, the boss needs you more than you need the boss, right? You don't go to work, they don't make their money, right? And yet, right, when you go to work, you know, in the very ways, it's the most authoritarian thing possible. They say jump, you say how high, right? You have the freedom not to work there, but you also have the freedom to starve. And that's a very alienating thing to deal with day in and day out. It's actually it's extortion, it's blackmail, right? And you look at the Star Trek universe, right? Is that present, right? Does them not going to, man the con station or, going to work on a starship, are they threatened with eviction? Are they threatened with the fact that they won't have their material needs, their livelihoods threatened if they, don't do what Picard says or Kirk says? Of course not, right? Does Dr. McCoy, does Julian Bashir, do they charge a premium or a copay when they kill you, right? Do they charge you? Do they check your Starfleet insurance card? No, they just give you hypo spray and you're on your way, right? Do they charge rent, right? Do they charge, do you get a W-2, right? Do you get paid for those types of things, right? In the same way that we understand it under capitalism, right? Now, of course, Star Trek is not Marxist, never was, but it presents a future where it can only be achieved by understanding what Marxism says in real life, meaning a struggle of class forces, right? Producing things of value, producing, using labor power to produce things. But in reality, we actually don't actually run society. Although we actually do run society, we actually don't call the shots. So for me, discovering Marxism was just kind of me kind of understanding, like, why can't we just get to a world where we can just live, right? We have the time to actually pursue all of our passions without having this Damocles sword literally hanging above our heads of debt, of eviction, of being put out on the street, or if you are sick, God forbid, that you know, it's a choice between being sick or being destitute, or a choice between putting food on the table or working a job that is completely dehumanizing. And for me, I think that was the beginning to say, is a better world possible? And how do you get there? Is it something that, is it just purely aspirational, or is there actually a way forward? And I think Marxism provides that necessary answer. There is a way forward. It's not just this pipe dream, this constantly receding horizon. No, it's absolutely attainable.
I have to confess that for most of my life, I knew next to nothing about communism or Marxism or socialism. I mean, honestly, I still don't know much. And it's mostly because, in addition to communism and socialism being demonized in the U.S., I got very little education about economic science in general in my schooling. Maybe it's just my school, but I suspect that it's true of many American students. And it's distressing that pro-capitalism, pro-socialism, whatever, kids aren't getting more education in economic theory.
Absolutely. And that's not by accident, because one of the most fundamental understandings of the class struggle is in a book written by Vladimir Lenin. The famous Russian revolutionary wrote the book State and Revolution, which analyzed what is the state? What does it actually exist as? Why does the state exist as it's currently constructed? How did it evolve? Did it come out of the sky? And what purpose does it serve in society?
Right.
And in a lot of ways, you know, to paraphrase it, you know, what Lenin was saying in State and Revolution was saying, in the final analysis, the state is just the armed bodies of men. They're there to protect private property, or rather the private ownership of property.
Right.
Meaning that because someone has a piece of paper, a contract that says, hey, they own this piece of property, capital, if you will.
Yeah.
And because they own it in perpetuity because of this piece of paper, they can extort from you your labor power because you need to work and add value, right? That's the key thing, is that actually work capital is useless without the workers adding their labor power to that capital to create all sorts of things, goods and services, right?
Right.
But because you need them to pay you a wage, that's why they continue to come back and work for them day in and day out. But here's the thing, is that you produce so much more value for them than what they actually pay you, right? And you continue to build, right? You continue to build the value, the services, the products, right? And they extract all of that, right? And they'll give you just enough to feed you. And here's the thing, you know, we've reached the point where they don't barely give you enough to feed you, barely enough to give you pay your bills. You know, benefits have been eroded left and right, right? But the idea is that you produce far more value than what is given back. And that's the inherent exploitiveness. And that's what that's what Marxism understands, is it explains this is the surplus value of your labor power that's being just literally scooped up every single day and just added to a giant, giant pile. And that is, you have no ownership of that. That is gone as soon as you do it, because that's the contract. Hey, you work for us, right?
Yeah.
And here's, you know, something, here's a wage that continually is eaten away by inflation year after year, right? You can't even buy anything.
Right.
In reality, you have to work multiple jobs, right? People work second, third job, gig jobs, drive for Uber, whatever, right? It's not even enough, right? That's where the exploitation has reached such ridiculous levels, which is where we're at now in 2020, right? What we know as the complete crisis of capitalism, right? So in terms of, to answer your question in a kind of a roundabout way, why is it not taught? Because in a lot of ways, that's how the ruling class maintains its control, is it has to do it through ideology. It has to do it through education, the beliefs, the culture, the ideas that are out there. That's the only way they can actually maintain their control, because the working class outnumbers the ruling class exponentially. There are far more workers. There are far more people that are in the proletariat, that are in the working class, that have to earn a wage, right? Paycheck to paycheck, instead of just, you know, collecting rent or, you know, collecting property, right? The only way they can maintain their control is through ideology, is through like, hey, well, you're free to work. We all have the freedom here, right? We're, you know, we all have these great individual liberties, right? That's the illusion, right? That's why so much is pumped into teaching history and economic theory in a particular way. They don't teach you Marxist economics, right? They teach you in a particular way. But here's the ultimate backstop. when that starts to erode, at the end of the day, you're going to have what Lenin called the armed bodies of men. So that's the police and the military. So when push comes to shove, when those illusions start to shatter just because of the experience of the people realizing, like they do now, that it's kind of a lie, then the backstop is, well, we got the guns. We have the arms. We have the armed bodies to make sure that I get to protect my private property, my ownership of this. And I think that is the fundamental key to understanding all this is the role the state plays, which is mediating between these two classes, the working class and the ruling class, which are inextricably in opposition to each other. And the state exists to mediate those tensions as much as possible. But of course, that can only hold for so long. And that's why I think we're in this particular period of time where there's so much social economic unrest. It reflects the crisis on a systemic level, on a worldwide level.
Yeah, that's fascinating. There's a knee-jerk reaction of fear and psychic terror that your average American has when somebody mentions, you know, communism or socialism. I was talking with my girlfriend about talking with you and how I was trying to read up on socialism, get a better understanding of it before our talk. And she immediately just blurted out, well, it's nice, but it doesn't work. And I remember having said that hundreds of times myself, having really no idea what I was talking about, getting no education about it, except the SSR was bad, and having no idea, you know, what was really behind things.
Yeah, I mean, that's part and parcel of the nonstop ideological battle that capitalism has to wage, because that's the only way you can kind of keep a lid on these things. And even then, it's barely holding on, right? It's actually bursting at the seams. And of course, there are examples of those countries that had successful revolutions, but obviously the USSR collapsed, right? So how do you explain that in a way that's Marxist, in a way that's not anti-communist, but explain, like, what was the Soviet Union? What happened to it? What are the lessons that we learned from it? As with so many other revolutions that were either socialist in nature or not socialist in nature, what is a revolution? Why do they happen? Why do they succeed up to a certain point? And why ultimately, you know, they probably don't succeed because we're still talking about it. It's understanding in reality kind of the material motor forces of the class struggle that's happening underneath. And, you know, a real short answer, what a revolution is one social class displacing another class. That's what a revolution really is. Nothing more, nothing less. And that is something that is important to understand, because capitalism will tell you, you know, revolution isn't possible. It's, you know, it's not doable. It's not possible. And that they also use the word revolution to describe all sorts of things, except an actual revolution, right? You know, a blender might be revolutionary. This new taco is revolutionary. This new, yeah, you know, Honda Civic is revolutionary. Everything except an actual revolution, right? So yeah, again, it's part of that kind of ideological struggle that it has to wait, right? It has to wait to confuse the workers. To say, hey, there's no other way is possible. And I think, you know, in a lot of ways, you just have to patiently explain to people and kind of demystify that. And I think a lot of people kind of understand that once you start putting it in those terms.
It sounds exhausting, not only keeping up the propaganda wing, but also having to explain to people about it the entire time. But I'm glad that you keep it up. Star Trek fans come in all political flavors, which itself is weird, and maybe we can touch on that later. But Star Trek fans of every type love the egalitarian utopia of the future of the Federation. You know, it's a world where you never go hungry. There's amazing technology. Nations aren't at war. We're in space. And it's a beautiful dream. But as depicted on screen, it has very little economic component, other than a few characters saying, we don't chase wealth anymore. And, you know, as you mentioned, no Star Trek character is worried about getting evicted or having to pay their mortgage. But that's it. It's like the people who created Trek said to themselves, you know, money problems suck, so they're not going to exist in this paradise future. Now let's explore. And that's really it.
Yeah, so I think that's one of the paradoxes of Trek. And in a lot of ways, I actually like the fact that they don't specify it. Because if they specify it, then I know that I will inevitably be disappointed in it. Because they, you know, the writers that write Star Trek, it is Marxists like to use the term contradictory. There are a lot of contradictory forces at play in society. In the same way, Star Trek is a contradiction, right? It is this show that talks about a utopia, talks about post-scarcity, talks about not having money, although there are instances of money as well. But it does it in a very completely utopian way that doesn't explain any of these types of things and views it as more of an individualistic choice. If only humanity just became enlightened enough, if we just walked in each other's shoes, if we just were nicer to each other, kinder to each other. These aren't these are not bad things, by the way. I'm not saying we should be
to
each other. We should walk in each other's shoes. We should have empathy. Of course, that's what's so great about Star Trek. It's almost that inherent corniness, but a corniness that is born out of legitimate genuineness, right? And it's but that is not in and of itself enough. It is in that way aspirational and utopian in the sense that, you know, we can just only aspire to be better, but we can never really attain it. And in reality, that's actually a very pessimistic message. But it's coming from a perspective of a liberal perspective. And Star Trek, and for the most part, is a liberal show in the sense that it talks about these liberal values that came from the liberal bourgeois revolutions, right? About the individual and earning certain rights, those types of things, which at a certain particular period of time in society was a progressive step forward. It was a progressive step forward from feudalism, right? We talk about these different stages of society, how revolutions don't happen, but people always seem to forget that feudalism existed for thousands of years, right? Kings, queens, lords, you know, real Game of Thrones stuff, right? Saying, hey, we had the divine right of kings. You work this plot of land, you serf and peasant, and you work until you die, and your children's children work this plot of land because of such and such, right? At a certain point, those went away, right? Through a lot of revolutions, right? Bourgeois revolutions, but revolutions nonetheless, right? That gave way towards liberalism and the development of capitalism. Capitalism came through a revolutionary break from feudalism, right? In the same way, we view that socialism is the necessary next step of humanity, a break from capitalism, because capitalism no longer serves any sort of productive or progressive role. We're well past feudalism. We're well past all those types of stages. Why don't we actually run society? So with Star Trek, it's written from that perspective of it doesn't posit a clash of these forces or these different classes at all. It's written from a very individualistic perspective, a very humanist. I say humanist, but you know, I would say socialists also fight for humanity as well. So I don't want to say that only liberals have a monopoly on humanism, but coming from a perspective that we can only change ourselves. We can only change our individual actions, and that there is no collective action possible, and there's no struggle that's possible. And it's also, Star Trek is written from the perspective of a commodity, a product, right? So it's also owned by CBS and Paramount, right? So they got to produce product. That's why CBS All Access exists, right? That's why you got to, you know, pay to play and that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
So it's very contradictory as well. So how could it ever actually have a fully fleshed out revolutionary perspective? So that, for me, on some level, I'm glad they don't flesh it out, because I know it'll inevitably disappoint me. But that doesn't mean I don't enjoy Star Trek. What I love about Star Trek is because it shows you that even just posing these very, I would say, basic, very fundamental questions, it naturally invites a revolutionary answer. Why can't we live a decent life without extortion, without alienation, without the pressure of, you know, if you don't do this, you're going to starve, you're going to, you know, your children will suffer, you'll have hospital bills, what have you, right?
Yeah.
These very basic fundamental questions cannot be answered within the framework of wage labor, cannot be answered under the auspices of private property, of all those types of things. It can only be answered through a revolutionary means. So in a way, I always joke, you know, Star Trek made me into a Marxist, but Marxism actually made me a better Star Trek fan in the sense that I actually don't get ground down into some of the canon minutiae and working everything out, although I love all of that. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. But it's also, you kind of have to let go of that on a certain level, because it is a product that needs to sell subscriptions, that need to move product, that kind of stuff. And ultimately, what if, you know, imagine the types of Star Trek stories we could tell if we could actually write Star Trek stories without, you know, CBS or Paramount wielding, you know, intellectual property law against us. What if it was just, you know, public domain for us to write stories, whatever we want to. Stories that we don't have to worry about, is it going to be profitable? Is it going to have a mass audience, right? It would just be like the myths and lores of any other time, right? Not constricted behind, this is a product by CBS and Paramount and has to be this type of thing, right? So that's the thing about Star Trek, is that by its nature, it's contradictory, but these contradictions are exactly what gets people asking these questions. It's like, this seems so simple. Why can't we get there? And it's not just a question of us being kind to each other on an individualist perspective. It's actually a question of power. It's a question of struggle. And Star Trek, as much as I love it, never quite gets to that point, because it really is just aspirational.
Yeah, aspirations are important, but I like that idea that they can't give us the special sauce to beat capitalism. They're trying to sell us something here. So, of course, it can only be an aspirational fantasy. I think, as far as TOS goes, I think that Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock are getting paychecks still. You know, like, there's a lot of talk about the economy and it being utopian, but a lot of the missions they go on are one of a purely economic concern. They're protecting mining rights or acquiring mining rights, and they're bargaining for resources and protecting shipping lanes. And there seems to be a fully operating, possibly, you know, enlightened capitalist economy in the background of TOS.
So I think that's a very good question. And I think a lot of the, I would say, misconceptions about money come from, again, that perspective of not understanding Marx's economics, class economics, and viewing it as kind of like a zero-sum proposition, a very utopian proposition, right? It's either we have money and it's capitalism, or it has to be completely, you know, money doesn't exist as a form whatsoever, right? Mm-hmm. And actually understanding Marx's economics is understanding there's a transition, there's an entire transitionary epoch in between capitalism and communism. It's called socialism. Socialism is a transitionary stage between capitalism and communism. That's why I always laugh to myself that, oh, people say, hey, I'm a socialist, not a communist, right? Whereas me, I'm both. It is, you need one for the other. One does lead to the other, right? It's understanding these terms devoid of kind of the propaganda that's been around it. And the idea of money, here's the thing. Money has existed actually before capitalism, right? Capitalism is a particular form of ownership of property and of capital. But money as a form, especially as an exchange form, existed far beyond or far before capitalism. The idea being, and it's a very simple materialist explanation, after a certain while, bartering was no longer going to cut it. Meaning I can't, for certain transactions, I can't just, you know, automatically always equate, I'm going to give you exactly 3 pounds of sugar for this collection of beads, right? At a certain point, as an economy gets larger, as a community gets larger, as we have a greater type of shared production, you can't just be able to have this one-for-one exchange with inherently different types of goods and services. Mm-hmm. There has to be a universal form of exchange, right? And that's where money started evolving from, right? It came from a place where we needed something that was standardized to say, this is acceptable as value, can be exchanged in whatever form, or exchanged for all sorts of goods, as many universal exchanges that are possible in order to facilitate a greater level of exchange and commerce, right? And that's what people don't understand, is that they assume that commerce has to equal capitalism. It has to be the same, right? So, you know, you always hear those gotcha questions. Oh, you're a communist. You get paid. You use money. You pay for clothes. You pay for food. I mean, that's very hypocritical of you. And it gets, for me, I love those types of questions because it's so easily refutable, but it's constantly refuted. Like, oh, you use money. Clearly you're a sellout, right? The idea is how money is evolved. Why is money used in the way it's used? And more importantly, who gets to use money? Who gets to hoard money? And more importantly, how does money under capitalism becomes not hijacked, but it becomes a way to extort people, right? It becomes a way to literally become oppressive and repressive, as opposed to just being an exchange form, right? It becomes a commodity form, and that commodity form then, because of the private ownership of capital, becomes hoarded, right? And because Yeah. And because you hoard those resources and you have armed bodies of men and apparatus to protect those scarce resources, you can then use various levels of coercion to get people to do things. It's either we coerce you with, we don't give you money, so then you can starve, or we can beat your head in, right? That's inherently behind the state, right? Behind those types of coercions, that's the 1-2 punch. We'll coerce you with wage slavery. And if not, we actually have an apparatus to crack heads if possible, right? And to protect those that have access to all of those types of things. That's what capitalism is, right? That's what private ownership means. Money in itself doesn't necessarily mean Quark's type of capitalism, right? But that's exactly what capitalists want you to think. It's like, oh, you use money, therefore you're a capitalist, right? It's a very easy way out of saying you can't change things, right? It's not possible. These are the ways things have always been. And that's not true. Capitalism is actually relatively a very new historical development, only happened in the past few hundred years because of industrialization and because a particular evolution and revolution away from feudalism, right? Money as an exchange form can be inherently not exploitive, right? If it's just used as a form of like a credit or a token, right? Where it ceases to really have that, all that weight that's put into it, that, you know, the pursuit of money, right? Which is why, you know, the idea that, you know, we are beyond the pursuit of money, like Picard says, is inherently a revolutionary statement. Money is just becomes something that it almost becomes, when it loses its meaning under capitalism, it then becomes its opposite. It becomes almost like a credit, a token. It becomes meaningless. It's just a form of exchange, just a means to an end, not, you know, necessarily this thing that you use to command other people and extort other people and coerce other people, right? And the idea of communism, right, the idea that at some point you can get rid of money, comes from the idea of you will have eventually at some point the productive forces are so productive that you produce an overabundance of goods and services where almost the need for a money exchange is almost rendered moot, right? That there's so much of everything and everyone has free access to it. Why would anyone want to hoard anything, right? Why would anyone want to kind of to have money as the form that we know it now? It presupposes the development of the productive force on such a level that we can provide for everyone on a exponential level. And the dirty little secret of capitalism is we've already reached that point right now in 2020. We actually have enough to feed and house and care for everyone medically, care for everyone's health. It's actually not that difficult to make sure that people don't starve, don't die of thirst, don't die of exposure. It's actually not that hard. We've already done it.
Yeah.
The question is, who controls the resources to distribute those types of things?
Yeah.
We actually already live in a post-scarcity society, which is why I often think the argument that, oh, socialism and communism and Star Trek, only possible when you have replicators, this magical box that replicates things.
Yeah.
It's a very disingenuous dodge, because guess what? We have all of the technology and productive technique to make sure that people don't die of hunger, thirst, exposure, you know, have basic medical care.
Yeah.
The question is who controls those means to distribute those types of things. And the question is very obvious. The workers don't control that. It's the bosses. It's the capitalists that really control those things.
Yeah. If you had to characterize then the society that we see, say in the 24th century on TV and Star Trek, with what little we see, I mean, what kind of economy would you call it?
So actually, you know, I think this is, again, another great question. I think I would do my best to kind of fill in the gaps with my own political persuasion, my own political analysis. So, you know, there are many forms of communists. You know, I'm a Leninist. I'm a Trotskyist as well, believing in the idea that a revolutionary is necessary. Building an actual vanguard party is essential. And having a worker state is essential for that transition stage in capitalism and between capitalism and communism. So my analysis of the Federation Starfleet is actually my analysis of what the USSR was and what it turned into. The idea of the Soviet Union in the October 1917 revolution was the most momentous event in human history. It was the first time that the working class was able to take power and hold power,
right,
from capitalist counter-revolution. There are other instances, like in the Paris Commune, 1871, where the workers for a month period were able to take power, but they were brutally repressed by imperialist forces because they didn't defend themselves. With the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution, the capitalists were actually expropriated. Capitalism was eliminated. Landlordism was eliminated, right, in Russia, but also in the Soviet Union, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. It was a voluntary union in the early stages of the Soviet Union, a voluntary union of these republics that came together to form the first worker state in the history of the world. The word Soviet is a Russian word for council. Mm-hmm. That was the idea of workers' power, that the workers themselves know how to run society because they already run society. They actually produce things in factories and workplaces, in schools. They already know how to do those types of things. But how is that translated into the political sphere? And that's what the Soviet Union, the term comes from, right? It was a union of republics that were based off of Soviet power, direct control, these workers' councils, right?
Right.
But of course, it degenerated into a bureaucracy. That's because the revolution was isolated. You know, after the 1917 Russian Revolution, people forget, and it's not taught, there was a civil war that happened. The United States participated in, by the way. They tried to snuff out the revolution because they understood it was a threat to every single capitalist country around the world. The spread of the social revolution, which is what revolutionaries want. It's what I want, right? Socialism is nothing if it's not international. The idea, workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains, is still true today as it was in 1848. So they have to prevent it from spreading, right? So they have to isolate the revolution, embargo it, make sure it, you know, suffers, you know, shortages of things. And then you try to discredit it that way, to say, hey, you know, they wait in line, right? You know, they wait in, you know, line for bread, and you know, that's so really bad there. Forgetting the fact that Russia was a semi-feudal country in 1917, right? And capitalism had no problem with that. It was a czar. They had no problem with that, right? But it came from that incredibly backward pace and actually beat the United States, the leading capitalist power, to space, right? It shows you the power of a planned economy, even though it degenerated into a bureaucracy that is known as Stalinism, right? The idea of socialism can only be built in one country,
yeah.
A bureaucracy that could only exist and spread because the revolution wasn't spread to Germany, wasn't spread to Hungary or Italy or any other countries that Lenin and Trotsky at that time were banking on. They were banking that the revolution would spread to other countries and aid the nascent revolution in Russia, right? It had to spread in order to help the workers, right? It cannot, you know, and that is true back then as it is today. And that's what happened, is because the revolution was isolated, a bureaucracy again to emerge, right? To then become self-serving, to protect the gains that he had won, but protect it in a very craven, self-interested way. So anyways, that's a very, not so short, but as best as I could.
Give the background.
Explain.
Yeah.
Explain the how I view the Federation. The Federation is what I would consider a degenerated space worker state, in the sense that it has all the benefits of a planned economy, has all the benefits of not having capitalism or landlordism as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's degenerate in the sense that it actually doesn't have the legitimate workers, the organs of workers' power that was in the early days of the Soviet Union with the workers' control, the workers' Soviets, right?
Mm-hmm.
The reason why I say that is because throughout Starfleet's history, throughout Star Trek canon, we see all these instances of Starfleet having a very bloated bureaucracy.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of badmirals, right? There's so many, you can count the number of good admirals on like one hand, right? And all the other badmirals, and I'm not even counting Section 31,
yeah.
But all of the other, you know, the entire bureaucracy, right, that is very self-serving. I'm a big fan of Lower Decks. I don't know if you've been watching, but Lower Decks is actually a great, you know, they don't intend to actually write a Marxist analysis of Star Trek, but it's the perfect Marxist analysis of Star Trek. Starfleet is portrayed as incredibly self-serving. they kiss butt, they kiss ass to kind of get to advance, right? Yeah. They actually don't know what they're doing. There's nepotism, there's cronyism, right?
Yeah.
All things inherent and endemic in a bureaucracy, in a degenerated worker state, but also endemic under capitalism, right?
Yeah.
So that's the only way you can explain, like, that doesn't mean, but at the same time, that doesn't mean that you throw everything away, right? That's where Marxism is so important. It understands these contradictions and explains things because these contradictions. Starfleet is a walking contradiction, but that contradiction is still a huge progressive step forward from the world we live in right now. That's why it's still aspirational.
Yeah.
Right. So it's great that they don't have to worry about rent. It's great. They don't have to worry about, you know, paying a copay. That's the worker state aspect of the Federation.
Yeah.
It's degenerated in the sense that there's a top heavy corrupt bureaucracy that runs everything. It's not actually run by the people that run society. You know, I always say, especially with Lower Decks, why don't the actual Lower Deckers choose who their superior officers are? That's what workers' control is. That's what Lenin said workers' control was, is that you elect your own leadership, you can recall them anytime, and the leadership doesn't make more money than the average worker, right? But that doesn't happen in Starfleet, right? It replicates the ranks of bourgeois navies, sure, right? It replicates the ranks of bourgeois capitalism, right? You know, the captain is the boss, right? Why don't the Lower Deckers vote who their captain is? And if they don't do a good job, they replace the entire senior command, right? But but here's the thing. They can't write that because the writers of Star Trek write from their own experiences. And their experiences, for the most part, come from capitalism. Right. They don't know, they can't extrapolate what they don't know yet. So that's the thing with Star Trek, is it's contradictory, but it's actually a useful tool to explain all these ideas. So that's how I would view, you know, 24th century Starfleet and the Federation.
That's fascinating. There's that thread of DNA of the series' origin as kind of a Cold War parable. And of course, as you mentioned before, the naval traditions of Horatio Hornblower or what have you. Do you think, well, let's talk about the state and its organs of special armed men. Do you think that Starfleet represents that, the organ of the state? Like, if we're watching this great utopian story about space explorers that are in a military, I mean, that's the contradiction as well, I guess.
It is. And I think that's, again, going back to the liberalism of Trek, is that it sometimes likes to give some lip service to a soft form of pacifism. Mm-hmm. And as Marxists, we understand Marxists are not pacifists. I'm not a pacifist. Revolutionaries are not pacifists. That doesn't mean that we like war as we know war as it is. We understand war as a product of class society, of class antagonisms, right? That's why we have a famous line that still resonates to this day: no war, but the class war, in the sense that we understand that wars that has ravaged humanity throughout history is not just a failing of, that's just human nature. That's just the inner demon, the inner monster of humanity. And you can only tame it, right? War is an endemic and something that will never go away. That's a very utopian, very liberal way of looking, individualistic way of looking at things. As a Marxist, I understand war as a product of class society, as a product of antagonisms that don't need to exist. And because of those antagonisms, imperialism results, war results to dominate, to control resources, right? But if you eliminate the need, if you eliminate that scarcity, which is artificial, if you eliminate all those types of things, you eliminate the need and cause for war. But that doesn't mean that we're pacifists in the sense that the violence of the oppressed is the same as the violence of the oppressor. So for me, how I would answer that question of like, whether it's Starfleet as explorers and military, and is that a betrayal of Starfleet's ideals? For me, as a Marxist, I view that as just liberal hogwash, right? The idea that, war is inherently bad, you know, and then we got to do everything we can to avoid that. That's not true, right? There are wars of liberation that are actually good to fight, which is why I love Deep Space Nine, by the way. It's my favorite Trek, is because it posits some of these revolutionary notions in a way that is not seeking a revolutionary outcome, but nonetheless asks those questions. For example, Kira Nerys is a Che Guevara in space, right? There's a Space Che shirt that was sold for the What You Leave Behind DS9 shirt, where Kira Nerys is portrayed in the famous Che shirt. Right. It's a revolutionary war. The Bajorans fought a just war against their Cardassian occupiers, against the Cardassian imperials, and that's good. Yeah. That's a good thing. That's a gore that should be supported, right? That pacifism has no answer for those types of things, right? You cannot, you know, negotiate your way there or talk your way through there. There was an irreconcilable antagonism. With Starfleet, I think it's one of those things where, you know, I think it's great that you want to be able to explore. Don't get me wrong. That's exactly what Starfleet should do. But the apprehension that, oh, it's not just military, but it's also exploration, that famous line, oh, Starfleet's NASA, not the Air Force, the Navy. It's just liberal. it's kind of liberal whitewashing of American imperialism, right? Like, yeah. NASA is far and parcel of the United States. The United States is an imperialist power. Yeah. NASA waged its space race to discredit the worker state of the Soviet Union. There was no benevolence of exploring space. They had to beat the communists because they were beaten, right? So they had to show the value of beating them, right? So the idea, a lot of liberal hand-wringing, oh, you know, we got to be more NASA as opposed to, you know, the Air Force, whatever. It's all the same, right? There is no difference, right? There's no fundamental difference between the two. And I think that's the difference between a liberal take of Star Trek versus a Marxist take of Star Trek. And it all depends on when do you use force? What is violence? And, you know, it's a question of their morals and ours, in the sense that whose class interests are at play here. It's not a question of the tactics in and of themselves, but the tactics of self-defense, of liberation, is not the same as the violence of the oppressor or through capitalist or imperialist war. So I think that's how I would answer kind of that, explorers versus militarism question.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good answer. One of the reasons that DS9 is so great is all the things that it can explore by setting itself nominally outside of Starfleet. And of course, it's one of the best examinations of class conflict and capitalism in Star Trek because of the involvement of the Ferengi Alliance, of course, which is, I think, the most explicitly capitalist society that we see in Star Trek. And, I'm reminded again of my sixth grade self, you know, shaking my head and thinking, yeah, communism doesn't work. But on DS9, we see how capitalism makes the Ferengi characters miserable and makes their lives horrible. And Quark loses his beloved bar over a technicality. Rom gets fed up with his dead-end job and he unionizes the bar. And it's the sort of, you know, it's the closest that we get to that kind of examination of that economic space that we really don't see in other shows.
Absolutely. I mean, Bar Association, of course, is that famous episode where Rom quotes the Communist Manifesto. Karl Marx, he doesn't say it, but I mean, you know, that's wonderful. That's amazing. One of these days I want to go to a convention and ask Iris Even Bear point blank whose idea was it to put the Communist Manifesto in that.
Yeah.
Because I consider myself a Romunist, right? I consider myself a communist in the future, going after the example of Rom, right? It's wonderful, right? And I think that shows you how these things can be explained. With Star Trek, because it has such a broad canvas, it has the ability to tell these types of stories that are very relatable. The union struggle is a struggle that is relatable to certain people, to a lot of people. And the union struggle is actually the first step towards socialist struggle. The first step towards communist struggle is work in the trade unions, right? Because in a lot of ways, trade unions are the first victory of the workers under capitalism. They're allowed to organize collectively, right? It is what Lenin says, the first school of communism is the labor union struggle, but it has to go beyond that. But it's a huge first step, right? So the fact that Rom was relearning this history, right? O'Brien talking about his ancestor being more than a hero, was a union man, all those types of things, experiences to throw in, you know, Bashir saying, Vulcans are logical, and that's why they're on the side of labor, right? And, you know, all those types of things, right? It's really, really great. And it shows you kind of how Quark could exist, right? Quark's bar could exist in a post-scarcity Starfleet, right? You know, he exists in outside of Starfleet, outside of the Federation. So they probably have to use money as exchange form in a different way than within the confines of the Federation. Although there's a great line in Bar Association where basically Sisko threatens Quark saying, you know, we haven't actually charged you rent, but we can start charging you rent, and actually kind of forces Quark to kind of like, oh, I gotta settle this labor dispute with my brother, right?
Sure.
It shows you, again, in a very unconscious way, that Starfleet, at least in that particular instance, has chosen not to be a landlord. They've chosen not to exploit
right.
Quark. And it's a very wonderful, like I said, I don't think it was intended that way, but it's, for me, as a Marxist Star Trek fan, I just use it as yet another example to explain, like, okay, wouldn't it be great if we didn't actually do, you know, charge, be that landlord in that particular way? I think Deep Space Nine, because of its setting on a space station that's under joint Bajoran and Starfleet administration, that's, you know, it's outside of the Federation, allows you these flavors to kind of to talk about these things in a way that Next Generation, as much as I love Next Generation, can't quite talk about. Because it doesn't have the same setting, it doesn't have the same characters to kind of talk about, you know, imperialism and even, you know, class politics in a very, you know, kind of a simple way, but still a very good way nonetheless.
Yeah. The most common argument that I've ever heard against socialist or Marxist economy is that, you know, you can't trust people. And that was the problem with the USSR and so on and so forth. And I have a cynical thought every now and then when I'm watching Star Trek or just sort of thinking about it, that one of the most fictional elements, I think, of their future is the incredible empathy and enthusiasm for cooperation that people of the 24th century in the Federation show. If we had a 10% of that now, we could do what you're saying. You know, I think we could feed everybody. We could do everything that we need to do. But it just seems so, especially at this specific time, it seems so far away.
Right. So I think on the one hand, I sympathize with that. I get that. It's coming from a very real place. It's coming from the place of everyday people saying their politicians have failed us. Nothing seems to change. They've been betrayed so many times. They've had so many false promises sold to them. That I don't blame them to say, hey, you know what? I don't trust them. We've heard this before. Oh, you know, we can do things better. And things inherently don't seem to get better. I would say that is understandable. But what I would add to this and say that's an incomplete understanding is that's understanding human nature as something that's devoid of a social and material basis, that it's somehow innate, that humans are this way.
Yeah.
When in reality, it's actually material conditions which shape social relations. It shapes human thought, right? You know, in a lot of ways, it's an understanding of how humans evolved, right? The human brain didn't evolve, or the human capacity, the human brain capacity to abstract and work together collectively and think on a different level than animals didn't evolve because humanity inherently just had a bigger brain. It evolved over time because humans could begin to manipulate objects. It could start building things, right? The ability to shape its environment actually enlarged the human intellect, enlarged the human brain and that capacity. It's actually the ability to collectively do things and shape your environment with others. That's actually what developed the human brain to where it is today, right? In the same way that I would explain human nature. And human nature is, and oh, everyone's incredibly predatory. Everyone's out for themselves, dog eat dog, right?
Yeah.
That's true only if this incentives exist because of capitalism to enable those types of things, for people to certain, you know, do whatever it takes to survive, right? Hustle and grind, all that kind of stuff, right? All those things are not innate, but they're learned and they're propped up by the state. They're propped up by the ideological edifices of the state and of capitalism, right? But when we grow up, right, when we're taught these, when we are born, and we're not taught to be capitalists when we're first born, right? We're actually taught to be incredibly empathetic. We were taught to care about people. That's why we care about people within our family or our close social circles. It's only when you start expanding out of that, right, that somehow the logic at some point changes. Well, at a certain point beyond my family or my close social circle or people that I know, I can't trust anyone, right? And what explains that? Is it something that's innate into humans, right? Or is it something that is actually outside of that? It's actually part of a systemic issue, right? The systemic issue of capitalism, right? So the reason why it's, you know, human nature is inherently predatory is because the system as set up right now pits workers against workers. It pits us fighting for crumbs and scraps, right?
Yeah.
It's literally a small ruling class, the bosses hoarding everything and saying, hey, that worker has an extra cookie, I have, you know, 10 million of them. That worker has two. You only have one. You should watch your back. He's trying to get yours, right? As opposed to saying, why are we in this room fighting over cookies to begin with, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's this argument. It's this ridiculous lesser evil is an argument here with the elections, right? Like, well, do you have the choice between a chicken dinner or a piece of crap, right? And do you choose a piece of crap or a chicken dinner? Like, this is not the time to choose between the two. The question that Marxists always ask themselves, why are we being forced to choose between these two options? Why are we being forced to eat this? Why aren't we actually determining the menu and cooking, right? As opposed to just accepting these two options, right?
Right.
In the same way, we can't accept the at face value that society as currently constructed has always been the way that it's been. It's evolved through struggle, right? The reason why we have the reason why society exists as it is, exists right now exists through constant struggle. That's why we have a 2-day weekend. It wasn't given freely. It had to be fought for.
Yeah.
And same way with an 8-hour workday, right?
Yeah.
Had to be fought for. But if we didn't have that fight, we wouldn't even have those things, right? But also shows you, what if we fought even more? What if we actually understood that we should actually be working significantly less? We should actually have, you know, maybe, you know, don't have to work for more than 2 or 3 days and actually get paid exponentially more, right? Why do we actually have to work in 5-day increments, 2-day weekends? And even now, even that's kind of a luxury. Some people have to work on the weekends, multiple jobs, right? Why is the week structured the way that it's structured, right?
Yeah.
These are all questions that we're just told, like, that's just the way it is. That's just Monday through Friday. Like,
yeah.
Who decided Monday through Friday, right? It's that history that's not taught to you, right? Because that's a history of beginning to question, why is anything the way that it is?
Yeah.
And ultimately, the working class, the workers of the world, can call the shots because they already do, in a way.
Yeah. It reminds me of what's going on now in terms of people being unable to go to work because of COVID restrictions and having people work at home, which is its own kind of mess, but and companies resisting it. Almost, I'm not sure if they're resisting it just because they don't want to give workers, they want to watch the workers all the time. They don't want the idea that they're going to have individuality, when studies have shown that it is much more economical for them to let people work at home if they're just going to be at a computer, because we've all got computers. And their resistance to that is, I think, really telling. I don't know where we're at on the countdown to revolution scale or things becoming too much, but as far as seeing, you know, like the explosion of the gig economy and just alternative ways of working and extra jobs like that, it reminds me of the guy in the movie who, you know, he is not looking too good. And that part where he coughs into the handkerchief and pulls it away and it's blood, that just kind of seems like the sign that we're at now.
Absolutely. I think there are two ways to kind of look at what's going on in the world right now, right? With the pandemic,
mm-hmm.
With the explosion of the Black Lives Matter protests again over the summer,
mm-hmm.
the worldwide conflict of worldwide conflicts in period to begin with around the world, but also climate change, all those types of things. It's what Marxists call the objective factor, right? The objective factors for a revolutionary break. It's all there, right? The elements of people not being able to live their lives anymore,
yeah.
coupled with the fact the ruling class can no longer rule in the same way. A case in point of that, like you said, is the pandemic, right? The greatest loss for the ruling class right now is not the virus itself. It's actually the complete loss of faith and trust that people have in bourgeois institutions and government around the world, everywhere around the world, right? There's a fundamental distrust that these institutions can do anything to solve any problem, right? Everything seems to be gridlocked. No one can even do basic functions, right?
Yeah.
It, you know, capitalism doesn't even have the ability to solve its own crisis, right? And the ruling class is representative of that, right?
Yeah.
But that alone is not enough, right? To prompt a revolution, right? And we know this by studying history of previous revolutions and what made them successful, also what made them go down and defeat is understanding these lessons. It provides a roadmap, a blueprint for the future. And the understanding that is the subjective factor. And the subjective factor is what Trotsky, another Russian revolutionary, said is the crisis of the leadership of the working class, meaning that the working class doesn't have a leadership that actually has a revolutionary mindset and understands that revolution has to happen, that's the way forward, that socialism is the next step in human evolution, and that nothing is possible, no advancement is possible at this stage without overthrowing capitalism, right? Of course, That is a tall order to ask. How do you build that revolution, that build that leadership, right? It's a question of understanding how other organizations in the past were developed, how their leaderships were developed in the past to kind of propel a movement forward. And that's what the crisis of capitalism right now is. It's the leadership of the working class, right? You look at the labor leadership in the United States and labor leadership in so many other countries. Why are they not talking about a general strike, right? Why are they not talking about actually shutting down the economy in order to achieve these basic fundamental demands, right? They're always left with the idea, let's just vote blue, right? Just vote harder, right? Just continue to vote harder, and somehow you'll just, you'll get those crumbs, right?
Yeah.
Forgetting the fact that California is a state that has a Democratic supermajority, and that state is currently on fire.
Yeah.
That state also happens to incarcerate one of the highest prison populations in the country, let alone the world.
Yeah.
And on top of that, the whole state is literally, up in flames, right? And this is a state that is supposedly incredibly super progressive, passes a cap and trade, and yet, has one of the highest income inequalities in San Francisco, Los Angeles, record police brutality, right? What happened in Minneapolis and in Oakland, Atlanta, those are all Democratic cities with Democratic mayors, Democratic police chiefs.
Yeah.
And, Ferguson happened under a Democratic president under Barack Obama, right? Standing Rock happened under Barack Obama and Joe Biden, right? So inherently, it's the leadership of the working class that continues to say, we can work within capitalism. We just got to elect the right leaders, right? The next answer is we got to elect more diverse oppressors, right? So as long as we still maintain hedge funds, as long as we still maintain banks and imperialism and a military that kills people abroad, we can have a black president, we can have a woman president, we have a gay president, as long as we get to have everything still the same fundamentally, we can change the figureheads, right?
Yeah.
And the problem is that the labor unions and the workers movement doesn't quite yet have a leadership in place to understand that actually the true power is not really in voting per se, but it's actually the workers' relationship to the means of production, meaning that you can actually shut everything down. You produce everything in value in society, right? Not a light bulb turns, not a wheel turns. Nothing happens without the kind permission of the working class. So why isn't the working class have a working class party in this country, right? The Democrats and Republicans are not. They don't represent the interests of the workers, right? They represent the interests of the bosses. Why don't the workers have their own party?
Yeah.
And that party organizing accordingly to go for a general strike. And that party works with other parties around the world to have a general strike around the world, right? Those are really what we talk about when we say building a social revolution, is that can we have a worldwide general strike, a political strike, not just an economic strike for wages, but to say we're going to shut this thing down because this entire system is rotten. That's the power that the working class has, but it has to be organized. It has to understand its own power, and it doesn't understand its own power because the labor leadership does everything it can to confuse it, to say, hey, let us worry about this stuff. You don't have to worry about that. That's why it's so useless, this old leadership that's there. And that's really the task for revolutionaries now, is to provide that leadership, to recruit and train others to build an organization, not just here, but worldwide.
Yeah.
To understand that you need an organization on a worldwide basis across borders to understand that that's what you need to be building for, a worldwide social revolution by a worldwide political general strike.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground and there's so much left to do. We'll have to have you back on again. But in the meantime, if people want to know more about these ideas and alternatives to our current system and growing social movements, what can they do right now?
Sure. So you can go on to socialrevolution.org. That is the U.S. section of my organization, International Marxist Tendency. We operate in 40 plus countries trying to build that revolutionary leadership. And you also go to our world website, Marxist.com, which has analysis of world events from a Marxist perspective. And that's the best way to kind of put yourself in touch with others who kind of feel the same way.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Will, for talking with me today. It's a fascinating subject, and it's a vital one, I believe. If people want to know more about you or Socialist Revolution, where can they find you online?
So you can find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @BoomerNiner. I go by the handle of the Star Trek Communist. I love talking about things both Star Trek and Communist. I do also enjoy cooking and food too. So get some food posts in there as well. But cool. I just love talking about all those types of things. And please hit me up anytime.
Well, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.